some of the absolute, well, not shocking, but surprising parts of the race was, number one, movie star. Like,
right.
Back in my day, the Spanish guys, they would do like 100K and then stop. All of a sudden, you have three movie star guys in the front,
right.
which is crazy. Which is like, I was like, man, these guys, and that isn't the first time. I mean, they have been riding like this clearly for the last couple of, well, for this season for sure. So then that's kind of a weird dynamic because all of a sudden you got a bunch of movie star guys up there that you're not normally.
We used to have, you know, Juan Antonio Flecha that would be participate.
Right.
He was in a Rabobank kit or something else, yeah. And he was not.
But it wasn't like
your
these
normal.
Spanish teams.
Yes.
Like when these teams never wanted to show to these races, they always asked to not go. And the World Tour just made them go.
Welcome to the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is Tyler Yonke, a special guest in. We're going to have you in more frequently here. Mike Sayers. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I love coming. This is fun. It's really great.
Right. So I'm glad you came in because this time it's going to be a special edition just talking about the classics, World Tour racing. We could also talk about your issues. Why don't we do that real quick? You've had some health problems and you want to get into it? Is that too personal?
No, it's fine. It's fine. Yeah, I blew my back out. I herniated a disc in my thoracic spine and I've been dealing with it for the last 6 weeks. I just literally this week, so it's Wednesday. On Monday was the first day that I could say I felt somewhat normal. I went through a month of hell, and so I have a new appreciation for people who have back issues.
Right.
I have a new appreciation for pain management because I went through a lot of that. And it was. I don't recommend it. Don't do it.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Well, are there ways to avoid it? You know, look, this is what you do.
Yeah.
Helping people, you know, with fitness, hopefully to avoid these injuries. We talked last time about old men trying to do other things just rather than cycling. So is this a core issue that you can help, or you previous injury or what?
Previous injury from 2001. I actually crashed at Tour of Flanders in this horrific crash, which someday I could tell you the story. It's long and complicated, but horrific. It was never addressed. So number one, get your injuries addressed. Number two, I mean, I prided myself on having a really strong core and functional movement strength. And it probably held this injury off for the better part of 2 years. But I think it was a ticking time bomb and it was probably partially herniated for quite a while. When I did it, just doing something completely easy and random. So I think that led itself to be for sure kind of a ticking time bomb. The one thing that they told me directly after was don't give up. Like, don't give up on your core and your back management. They said it's going to be hard to get back into it, which it's been a little difficult because I've been so sore and kind of stiff. But I am back into it now, and I'm not going to say I'm going to dig in any deeper because I don't think it's possible. But I'm going to get back to where I was, but starting really, really slow. So I literally am doing, you know, banded squats with like 5 pound weights and just coming back incredibly slow, and hopefully in the next like 3 or 4 weeks I'll be able to get back to where I was.
All right, so this is why we probably haven't seen you out racing at all.
Yes. Okay. I was flat on my face for 7 days, like literally.
You still could have competed, I'm
no,
sure.
No, I could. I
know when back injuries happen, I mean it can wipe you out.
It wipes you out. And I will say a couple adjustments for me happened. Number one, my personal dignity, level of personal dignity took a major hit. So things like having to lay down on the sidewalk in the middle of the street and have people walk over me, that happened.
Did you make any extra money that way?
Did not make any extra okay. money. But it gave me a new appreciation, and it did reset my, my physical expectations, which I think we all need at some point, especially I'm going to turn 50 in about 6 months. I think that it did help me maybe get ahead of the curve on that a little bit. And so I'm reassessing what I can do, how I can do it, and my approach.
And it will probably help you with clients just for empathy and understanding, kind of going through some of these things since, you know, as an athlete, you've always been top. And so sometimes it's always harder to understand those people that maybe aren't naturally gifted. And now the injury part can help with that.
Absolutely. Well. And I thought I was always really good at kind of putting my myself in other people's shoes, but this really took me to a whole nother level. And I'm really, yeah, I really have a lot of, you know, I don't want to necessarily say it's empathy, but understanding. I think that's a better word. I think my understanding of where people are coming from and the time it takes to do that is much better now. I have a couple of coaching clients that deal with some, have had some head injuries and some other things.
Right.
And I've always been really sensitive to that. Again, that is, it has helped me get even more in touch with that and just coming back really slow and easy and methodical. And again, like I've always been a detail guy or tried to be a detail guy. I think the truth was I was getting a little bit lackadaisical in my personal details. I think it slipped a little bit. I'm not saying it caused my injury, but it allowed me to reassess where I'm at and reset and build a new plan and get my point of contacts in town. So I have a chiropractor that I've worked with that has I've always used, but re-engaging with them. I've been using acupuncture, which has brought me a long way. I can't even tell you how far. I have some contacts there, physical therapy, just little things like that, which I've always, it just allowed me to re-engage with those people and for myself and to listen, sit and listen and not make any judgment and just accept the feedback and try to take it from there.
And we'll get into this, but there's another little side issue here that you just mentioned, head injuries. So my teammate, Nate Dunn, just had a concussion on a week ride. So, you know, the process of getting back for that is pretty big. I'm going to actually talk to Dr. Jason Braley. I think him.
Yeah.
You know, he's written some of the concussion protocols and some of those other things. And, you know, the UHC rally rider, the female that just committed suicide, you know, there's some talk about her brother was saying undiagnosed concussions may have led to some of this.
Right.
So side issue, because Terpstra crashed out. They said he was out for maybe 2 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
With a, I mean, this is a big deal. So, yeah. What's your take being a DS? You know, Tom Squeans went down a few years ago in on the Tour of California with the head injuries. And I mean, back in our day, you just shake it out. Football, same with that. You know,
yeah.
What was yours as a DS and a manager of riders worrying about head injuries, or was that even in your purview at the time?
It was absolutely. And in fact, when I was at the national team, we used to use a head injury protocol, a baseline system, where every single rider that came into the program would take a beginning of the year baseline test, which was kept on file. And anytime there was any question, I mean, more likely than not, I would hold a rider out, which is really hard, especially when if you're in Europe and these kids are kind of, for lack of a better term, like locked up, you know, they're just chomping at the bit to race. And then you ask them or tell them that they can't race because they have a head injury. But I was very open about the communication, and I think it's really important. I know for a fact that my very last race as a professional was Tour of Missouri, and I crashed 2 days left to go in the race. And I know for a fact I had a severe concussion, but it was my last race, and the team wanted me to, the team didn't prevent me from continuing, and I wasn't going to stop because I wanted to get to the end. And at the end of the day, if it had not been the last race I ever did as a pro, I should have, or probably would have stopped. That was for sure. That hurt me. Because there was months after that, there was lasting ramifications that I struggled with. And I just pushed through because I wanted to get to the end of my last race.
What were some of those issues dealing with riding the last few days with that?
Oh, for sure. Not switched on, like mentally, making bad decisions, not sleeping well, confusion, sensitivity to light. Like a lot of it just was confusion and not ability to make really good decisions.
My wife must think I have a concussion all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, well, don't they all?
Right. All right, let's get into this. So I'm going to do some quick questions for you and just rattle them off as quick as you can. So your favorite spring classic?
Oh, Flanders, for sure.
Okay. Spring classic or late season classics, which you prefer?
Spring.
Okay. Shimano, Campy, or SRAM?
Shimano.
Okay. Is that what you're riding now as well?
Yeah, but I've always been a Shimano fan.
Okay. Have you ever ridden Campy? Or like had a full team with that?
Yeah. Yeah. BMC, the first 2 years we ran full Campy, and it never worked on our frames.
Interesting. So, you know, back when we were younger, that was like C Record, right? Was like the big deal. Are they really that prominent anymore?
In Europe, they still hold their own in Europe, especially as far as I understand it, like in Eastern Europe. So Slovenia, Slovakia, gotcha. You know, Italy, they, most of the teams, you look at most of the Italian, like Conti teams, they're on Campi. But yeah, I think in Europe, they're still big. Even like New Zealand, Australia, I think they're still big. SRAM made a lot of inroads because their products are generally less expensive.
Right.
And they do now clearly have some technological advances, 12-speed hydro. Yeah. And with disc, I mean, they were ahead of the game on the whole disc thing for sure.
So that's the next one, rim or disc?
My gravel bike has disc, my mountain bike has disc, and my road bike has rim. I will say that I have done some big rides on my gravel bike on the road with disc, and I've done some of those really big descents like Mount Tam and things like that. Wow.
Much better.
So
I'm derailing myself here. So my issue with the disc is on the world tour level seems to be ease of changing wheels. Like, yeah. You know, you're out there, you have the follow car maybe, or you're in the brake, you have the old Chris Froome thing running up the hill on a spare bike. Did your team, were they using disc at all? Or when you were helping out, they probably haven't fully meshed into that yet.
No, disc was not even on the table back then. And my number one issue, my only really issue with disc is that you're asking people to reconfigure everything.
Right,
so if you're guys like us, and we probably have like four or five wheel sets that at this point are all rim, it's like you're asking me to get rid of those and then re-engage with disc. And that's a big outlay of cash for any cyclist. Right. So if there was I know there's not, but if there was a way that you could convert, it would be great. At the end of the day, I'm sure we're going to all end up on disc at some point. I certainly will. And so, you know, it is much more comfortable on descents, and you get a lot more control of it. In the rain, it's a lot nicer. You know,
I just got a new bike, and that was the exact thing of not going because I had a bunch of other wheels, and I'm like the whole process of going through that. So,
yeah.
Favorite race trip luxury item. So when you're on a race, anything you take specific books. I don't know.
Coffee.
Oh, I like that. is it hard to get good coffee in different areas of Europe?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're in Italy, no problem.
Right.
But if you're in, not to stereotype it, but like if you're in Spain,
right,
not as easy to get coffee. And if you have like an AeroPress. Super easy to do in the room. You can have it anytime you want. It costs a lot less money. You get your little Pete's like ground, and it gives you that little taste of home. I think a lot of guys are like that.
Okay. Best time crunch workout?
Jump rope.
Oh, wow.
Jump rope.
Old school. And then the last one, any tips or tricks for pinning your number?
Center of the back so that the officials are totally not happy with you.
That's the way to go. All right, let's get into this. So, look, the list of classics is long. What are some of the ones up until, and we can maybe talk a little bit more about Flanders in detail, some of the early season ones. We had Ghent, E3, Milan-San Remo. I know that's do you want to break out what you think is the difference between a classic and a monument, or the Venn diagram is overlapping on those?
I think the Venn diagram is overlapping. Okay. I mean, the monuments are just races that have been there the longest, that are the most prestigious, and they do mean a little bit more. But at the end of the day, you know, it's like playing in the big arena versus, you know, the medium sized arena. Right. So, I mean, the monuments carry the most weight, but in this day and age, I mean, if you win a non-monument classic, I mean, your contract's still going to go up.
Right.
Prestige still is there. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. The only issue I see at this point is that if we look at Flanders and like a lot of guys didn't race on the Wednesday before, and I'm sure we're going to get into this, but if you look at Flanders as a race, I think the guys that did race on that previous Wednesday physically probably paid for it in a negative way.
Interesting. So what about Strade Bianche? I mean, that's come up. It's fairly new, and I think it gets the viewer. I love that to watch. So the racers seem to as well.
I definitely think it should be right up there. Right. I think it has added so much. And from a scheduling standpoint, it has actually taken the two stage races, or the two races that guys use to prepare, Tirreno and Paris-Nice, In my day, Paris-Nice carry the most weight. If you went to Paris-Nice as a team and you won at least one stage, if you were not already at the tour, you were probably going to the tour if you won a stage. Now you add Strada Bianca into that equation. And now for my money, Tirreno is the more important stage race because you have Strada Bianca, you have Tirreno, and then you have Milan-San Remo. So my feeling is that the more the riders are looking at it, and occasionally they will change things up just to change things up, but more guys are going to Tirreno now, and it carries more weight, in my opinion, as opposed to Paris-Nice, which the coin used to be flipped over.
So it seemed like before, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong here, that it used to be Tirreno was more of a sprinters type of race, and maybe it's become more climbing lately. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, it generally has less of the big climbs. Like Paris-Nice ends with some pretty large mountain days at the end that are significant to the overall GC. Tirreno is more of a classics, using air quotes, like classics rider. But like when my day, Cadel was not doing Paris-Nice. He was going to Tirreno. It just, you get these GC guys that are going now, climber type riders that are going now. And Tirreno, just because of the scheduling and because with the addition of, I really do think with the addition of Strada Bianca, it has changed the dynamic of where the big riders are going.
Do you think you'll see more of, I mean, like Strada Bianca, you know, it's got the white roads and the dirt, and so everyone gets excited. But I mean, Flanders and these other ones with the Paris-Roubaix with the cobbles, that's probably worse of a road and situation. So it's exciting because it's just a little bit, it's smaller cobbles, right? It's little rocks. So yeah. Do you think you're going to see more of those races kind of come to the fore?
Well, I think you already have. I mean, you've seen races like Gent-Wevelgem and Paris Tours that have added dirt roads. And then you have a small race that a lot of people have never heard of, the Trofeo Braun, which is in France, which is only going to gain popularity.
We talked about that one last year, basically because the guy that won had the most freaky salute. He's going crazy over the finish. So yeah, yes, that one definitely winds through all the roads like that as well.
Yeah,
so.
And I do think you're going to see more of that as we go forward. I mean, this is where cycling is going. It trickles right down from the very top all the way down to the local grasshopper gravel type events. This is what people want to see. They want an experience. They want it to be exciting. They want to change it up. I mean, a race like Paris Tours, quite frankly, is not very dynamic. But all of a sudden, if you throw in a bunch of dirt roads, maybe it changes it. Gent-Wevelgem was, I'm not going to say it wasn't dynamic. It was. In my era, we descended on the cobble section, which I can tell you was the scariest thing ever. But prior to those climbs, there wasn't really that dynamic. So now you throw in some dirt roads, you make it's harder than it was. It clearly is harder than it used to be. And it changes the race, and maybe more riders go there because it's a better prep for what's ahead.
So let's talk real quick. Let's go over, review some of these. So Milan-San Remo, what was your take on that? And, you know, we saw Bettiol up the, what's the last climb?
Poggio,
thank you. Yeah. You know, with the front group there, kind of a fort pretend of things to come here.
Right.
But what was your take on that race besides just it's so dang long? Did you do Milan-San?
I did not do Milan-San Remo.
But I'm sure you've been involved in it.
Yeah, I've been involved in it. My take was that it was the first sign that maybe Peter was not great.
Right.
It was for sure a justification. That's not the right word. But justification that Alaphilippe is a megastar,
right?
Which, if you follow my Twitter feed, like 5 years ago, I said this guy was going to do this. I called it.
Was that when he was showing flashes here in California, or what did you see from him?
No, I watched him. He did Tour de l'Avenir 1 year,
mm-hmm.
and he went across a 2-minute gap on a descent in the Alps that the field didn't even know he made it across because he attacked right at the top of the climb. And he rode the descent, was like, I don't remember exactly, 10K long. Let's call it 10K long. In 10K on the descent, he rode across 2 minutes to the breakaway. Wow. And I believe he won the stage that day.
So he's, you know, maybe he's doing the right thing. You see some of these riders come out and they have Grand Tour aspirations. And so that's their focus. And he's kind of just taken the idea of, I'm going to clip off these 1-day races. I'm going to do these 7 stage races and kind of building himself. Do you think he's got Grand Tour aspirations?
I do. Okay. I do. I mean, I think we
need abilities then.
I think he does. I think we need to see what his time trialing can be.
Right.
But at the end of the day, what I said when I saw him at Lavenir was, this guy can't, he doesn't only go uphill well, but he actually descends better than everybody in the field. So in a situation like that, like, he can literally go across to a break on a descent.
Right.
So if he's in the front group, he goes across to the break, then he gets the break and it's at the end. Or if it's like Pays Vasco, a race like Pays Vasco, where the descents are super technical. I mean, literally he can take time out of guys on the descents, which is a whole nother weapon that a lot of guys don't have. Cadell was that way. This guy, I think, can win a Grand Tour. I do think the way he's doing it is incredible, because he's just slowly but surely building knowledge and strength and, persona.
Right.
That he can do this. And he's progressed incredibly well. There's another guy on the block that is just now coming to the forefront, which is a very similar guy. That's Max Schachmann,
yeah.
German rider. You can see he's on a very similar progression.
Well, he's winning this week.
Yeah.
That's why he's doing well.
Right.
Alaphilippe, one thing that's scary about, he kind of reminds me of a young Valverde, where he can climb, he can do all these things. We'll see about time trialing, but he finishes it off at the end of the race. I mean, to do Milan-San Remo like he did, it's pretty impressive.
Very impressive.
With the guys there,
very impressive. He played it perfectly. I mean, the hesitation at the end, I think, costs a number of guys. If they would not have hesitated at that 300 to go mark, Alaphilippe would not have gotten the jump on him. But if you go back even a week before, where he won that, I forget what race it was, but it was an uphill sprint at one of the stage races. I think it was Tirreno. It was Tirreno. Early in the week, he won a sprint stage out of the group, and he took off. It was an uphill. He took off at 200 meters to go, and nobody could come around him. And he was leading out one of his teammates right there.
Yeah.
You should have known, okay, this guy can win Milan-San Remo.
So then, and we'll move off of him real quick, but so the question is, how long does he stay with Dacona Quickstep then? Because they're not going to be supporting him on a GC-style.
Well, I don't know.
I would assume.
You don't know for sure.
Right.
I mean, they need a G. They've always lacked GC riders. So maybe he's the guy. Maybe he's the guy that comes in and actually gives them a reason to ride GC. It changes the dynamic of their team a little bit. But at this point, they're winning. Well, they lacked a little lately. But in the beginning of the year, they were winning everything.
Right.
And so maybe they sacrifice a little bit of that to win a Grand Tour, which, it's been a really long time since Quickstep, maybe back when they were Mape, was the last time that they won a Grand Tour,
right,
with Rominger or
right.
somebody like that.
Yeah.
So why don't we, it's really about time for that transformation. Who knows if they're going to do that, but he could definitely be their guy. But then maybe he goes to a team like Bora. My feeling is he could be the next specialized guy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
He's the next guy, like Peter is the guy yeah, now yeah. before it was Contador.
Right.
So it's like Contador, Peter, maybe he's the next specialized guy, and maybe they determine where he goes.
All right. Schachmann, riding with Bora, doing well. Did you ride with him or visit with him when he was out here?
Seems like a nice a little guy. Bit. I knew him from the under 23s because he was like double silver medal or silver and gold medal at Worlds. Plus he did all of the under 23. He was the leader of the German team and he got a ton of results. Very impressive.
Ghent. So Ghent we had coming out. Look, I'm watching this race and I don't know, 20K or so out, I'm seeing Christoph trying to make a move across. And I'm like, I was even texting with Chris and Curtin, but you know, Michelin man. I mean, he's a big looking guy in this white jersey, but he pulls out the win. So, and he obviously was hanging well at Flanders too. So what'd you make of that finish? So you had Christoph, Degenkolb, Nason, Vanderpoel, and Van Poppel. Matthew Vanderpoel, kind of the renaissance or the new guy coming out with Van Aert, kind of the two guys that are kind of making a show from the cyclocross.
Yeah, and so I think that did not surprise me about Christoph. I had him at BMC, and that's exactly the type of sprinter that he is. When it's really, really hard and everybody's on the limit and nobody has any legs left at the end, he's usually a guy that can come through. I can tell you that guy, he trains – He lives in Norway. He trains in the middle of the winter in Norway with like giant tires on, and he does these 6-hour rides. It's crazy. I mean, he's nuts. But he's one of those classic, incredibly strong sprinting guys that is tough as nails. It did not surprise me. I think it helped that he kind of it's funny because when the Colombian guy went to the Colombian sprinter
Gaviria,
when Gaviria went there, in the back of my mind, Gaviria went there because the head director there is the guy that found him at Quick Step, used to be the development guy at Quick Step. Anyway, Gaviria goes there, and I'm like, oh, that's the end of it for Christoph, because now you have a younger, faster guy there. But in some ways, I think it actually worked out for Alex, because Gaviria goes there, and then everybody's thinking Gaviria is the guy, and then all of a sudden Gaviria has a good early run but is struggling a little bit in the classics, and now Christoph has had a less aggressive early run, which he typically doesn't ride super well at those Middle Eastern races. He's usually not as good. Okay. He's got this huge engine. It takes him a while to get going. But when he gets that engine going, you better watch out, because he is incredibly strong.
So listening to and reading some interviews, it sounds like Christoph and Gaviria had a little good communication. He said, like, with 10K or less to go, Gaviria told Christoph, hey, I'm not in it. So he sits on his wheel as if he is, mm-hmm. kind of blocks it up there. And, you know, you mentioned guy coming over. There's a lot of egos taking place. That's a pretty selfless thing to do. One, for a sprinter to say, I'm not going to have it today. Because usually you just take it off anyway. But anyway, that was pretty impressive. And maybe those guys are going to work together. You know, you get some of these teams, movie star with all these stars, and then it just looks like a crap show sometimes the way they race.
So. Right. And I think that goes back, though, to Christoph not fighting it in the beginning and proving that he was willing to work for this guy. And the guy's like, oh, you know, he worked for me without question,
right?
Without hesitation. So, I mean, what does it hurt for Gaviria to go, hey, listen, in the end, he goes back to the bus and the team says, thank you. Right. Thanks for being honest.
Right.
Gaviria is going to get a shot again, clearly.
Of course.
You know, because he is one of the fastest guys, and he's proven he can win races like Milan San Remo and these other races. He's going to get his time. He's young. He's still a young guy. So, listen, Christoph, it's amazing for me to say, but he's kind of on the backside of it at this point.
Right.
He's scoring good points. And listen, he's a good leader. He in his team, he immediately sacrifices for the younger, faster guy, gets his opportunity, gains some confidence within the team. He's got Alan Piper there. Alan is a good recognition of talent and knows how to manage big egos. And I think it's all working out for them. I mean, they won a classic. Maybe Flanders didn't go quite as well as they wanted, but there was a lot going on there. I think they've had a good run already.
So it's finishing off with Ghent. You had, I don't know, did you see the women's race at all?
I saw a little bit. I saw the end of it.
Okay, yeah, me too. So Kristen Wild wins that. Corn Rivera was 23rd last year. I think she had won, or did she win Flanders last year? Or
Flanders? Oh, I know.
Apologies here.
Yeah,
well,
apologies.
But the big race that I saw there was the junior race. What is it, Simmons, who had won down in Redlands the last day. 17-year-old has an amazing. Did you get to see? Well, there wasn't really probably any video of that, but did you check in on that? Read some of the interviews.
And I did.
What was your take? And do you know him at all?
I don't know him. I know he's living, or he's from Tucson. He had been riding super strong down there all winter. I mean, I'm clearly at that age to watch him win the last stage of Redlands.
Right.
Whether the field was incredibly deep or not, it doesn't matter. Like, the thing about Sunset Loop is because it's so. It's a hard 130K with like no relent. Like, there's no caravan. There's nowhere to hide. And if you ride Sunset and you're in the front group, you have good form.
Well, if you finish, I mean, a lot of times, I don't know, it's the last day, but you look, the DNFs there or the time cut, even to get into the last loop on the crit part from the Sunset Loop. And then he was off with Corey Lockwood, who is just, you know, killed it that day. So to even get there, like you said, that's impressive.
It's impressive.
But he showed up on in Ghent as a 17-year-old.
Pretty
with
impressive.
With a beard that's...
Man-child.
Right. I don't even understand that. So look, I'm looking for more things for him. And there was an issue with his shoe. I guess he busted his shoe and had a spare shoe in the car.
That I didn't hear. But again, you know, you can see tough guy. He's at Lux. He's on a good team. Roy Nickman is giving him good direction.
Right.
He's, I mean, very clearly, again... the sport is getting younger. The sport is getting younger. It's like every major sport. The, you know, basketball and football guys are coming out earlier. They're getting younger, more experience, more life experiences, more racing experience. It's transitioning to cycling now. There is no way. I mean, when I retired as a pro, I was 39 years old. I do not see that happen. I mean, Valverde at 38,
right.
I really think that's it. I mean, there's a last superstar you're going to see that's going to make it that deep, because the guys are just getting younger.
Right.
You know,
and he's really motivated. Billy Ennis taking care of the junior team. Who else is on that team even the U23 is the ones that the U.S. might have coming up?
Well, we do have some solid U23s coming. They're clearly, most of them are at Action. Some we have like Gage Hecht is right. At Avello.
Are they getting a lot of classics chances over there? I mean, we hear Quinn's over there, but is the whole team, are they able to basically partake in all these races?
The Action guys?
Well, in the U.S., ones that would be riding for the U.S. team.
Okay, so the U.S. team is in a little bit of a transition. They don't have a big program this year. I just recently agreed to go back and start helping them again.
Okay.
So I'm doing Tour of California with them. I'll be directing the Tour of California national team. And then we'll run the Tour de l'Avenir program at the end of the year, the August trip. And right now, it's in a down transition. There's no doubt about it. The plan is Jeff Pierce, who is now the head of athletics right. there, his plan is to rebuild the program back to where it was when I was there over the next couple of years. I don't have any idea what the plans are long term. What I know is that one of my big requests from USA Cycling was to run the Tour of California program with the national team. They didn't agree to that until this year. This year, it's going to happen. We're going to have mostly under 23s on that program with one or two elite guys for leadership. So that team will be selected next week, and then we'll just move on from there.
So the U.S. team is in the Tour of California. Did Tour of California get a downgrade on their UCI?
No.
So how does that work for?
They're always allowed to have a national team.
Okay.
That's always been in the rules.
They just haven't taken that up?
I'm sorry?
Have they just not taken that up?
Yeah, up to this point, USA Cycling never decided to activate that ability. Number one, it's another team. So right. sometimes that means that a continental team could not go. Well, now the continental teams can't go anyway.
Right.
So it allows in this instance, there will be one or two elite guys from American continental teams that will participate.
Okay. Well, that's good then.
Yeah. So some of these teams like Floyd's or Danny's new wildlife team,
right.
they may or may not have a rider on that team that will allow them to, you know, those sponsors are important, very important. In yeah. fact, really important. And so I think it's a necessary situation where we are giving, if those teams can't get in because of the rules, then they should be able to have some kind of representation. So right. hopefully in a very small way, we'll be able to give them some representation.
Because I was bummed. It was nice to have the upgrade in the UCI, you know, ranking, but it cut out some of those Conti teams, which were yeah. a huge deal for the Tour of California. So that's at least a nice little loophole.
So at this point, we're going to have some of those riders there.
All right. So taking us back, let's hit Dwars and Flanders, and then Skil de Pres was today. So Vanderpool wins Dwars. That was very impressive. And then his ride in Flanders, some of the shenanigans that he was having in there. What'd you think of Dwars van Vlaanderen?
I thought it was great. I mean, I think it was a coming out for Vanderpool. I think we have found, I mean, for me, he is the guy of the classics. When I was watching Flanders and he crashed, I think I woke up my entire house because I I uttered an expletive because he landed on his face. It was unbelievable. And then he gets up. I mean, let's be honest. He was the strongest guy in right. both races.
Right.
He was the strongest guy. I've never, ever seen a guy that was off the back of the front. And the way that they were racing at Flanders, they were full gas from 80K out. I mean, that was incredible. And the fact is, if he doesn't crash, I think he wins. I think he wins Flanders.
Yeah, well, it would have been a much different dynamic. You had mentioned that you thought Dwars, I guess was what you were saying, was something that took something out of the riders that ended up...
Yeah, so finishing. There were some guys who
but
didn't
yeah, you think
go.
He would have won Flanders.
I think he would have won
so he
Flanders.
He was to be the exception.
he would have been the exception, but I think he was the strongest guy. I mean, I think he, for that week and the run in, he, and you know, he did Harlbecker. He crashed in the final sprint on the cobbles, and everybody thought he was out. Like, it looked like he maybe broke his collarbone. He like had this horrific crash, and then somebody ran into him. I mean, they're in the middle of the sprint. Right. He got T-boned in his like chest in the sprint, and everybody thought he was out. Then he comes back like a little over a week later and wins at Dwars, and then he goes to Flanders and has another horrific crash, which I think was his own fault.
Right.
Because he was trying to take the hot route, flatted or broke his wheel, and then face planted because he was riding a front wheel that didn't work with one hand, and then gets back on his bike and then gets back to the front group. And you could see all the directors were just shaking their head like, like, if this is what is to come, we may have found a guy that can literally win more Flanders than Boone in one.
It's almost like he didn't realize the gravity of the weight of the sport and that you're not able to do these kind of things.
No, but I think that comes from his background.
Right.
You know, I mean, his family is royalty.
Right. Andre van der Poel, Poledor, I think is his grandfather.
Yes, was his grandfather, yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. And, you know, there was another time during the race where he was back with the front group and he got caught in a weird, and he pulled that out too. I guess that's the way that, you know, I've got tired of hearing on the tour, oh, this guy used to do mountain bike racing, so therefore he's an amazing downhiller. And you're like, or Primus road jokes. Oh, he used to do ski jumping.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how that ties into it, but maybe the he used to do cyclocross does pertain to, you know.
Well, we can see already. I mean, these cyclocross guys are making an incredible transition. Right. For a while, like in our era, it was mountain bikers.
Right.
Now it seems to be the crossers can make the transition. Clearly, the longevity in road racing is a lot more than cross. At some point, you know, but it goes back, for me, this kind of goes back to this whole development. How do you develop young people? You know, how do you develop them into good road riders? And then tying it into like the Nika thing. I think what happens is these kids, they learn how to run it at a really high level for very short bursts, but they build this strength at the VO2 level when they're doing cross and mountain bike that road guys just don't get.
Right.
And then they just get the endurance by default. And the next thing you know, they're winning classics.
Well, I was amazed last year, actually this year too, with Wout van Aert taking on Strade Bianche, and I'm coming off of the cross season. And yes, you have this high octane engine, but can you do it for a long duration? And these two are showing. Now, cyclocross, from what I've heard, for these two, they're like megastars, and they could probably make their money and be just fine in cyclocross. But if they really want to make their mark in the world of cycling, globally, they're going to go road.
They're going to go road.
Yeah.
And you see these guys, like I mean, everybody thinks, again, this goes back to the Eurocross thing. If you really understand how the Eurocross season works, these guys are doing some of these second level, so 2.1 level stage races in Europe starting from June. So like Van der Poel's team, they'll start doing, you know, Tour of Belgium, some of these lower stage races that a lot of people haven't heard of, all summer long, building up, getting their fitness. It's for them, the middle of the summer is the early season. It's like, you know, the February for road guys. Then they come, that's because cross, there is no, there's no races to train in. You got to be, the first day you hit a cross race, you got to be going full gas. Like, those guys spent the whole summer racing and getting fit and getting ready to go. And they're those cross teams are a big part of the Belgian summer stage race community. And then they just transition that right to cross season. And then for the next 4 months, twice a weekend, every single weekend, they're full gas.
When did they take their time off?
time off for them would be like February, right after Worlds. Okay. They shut it down for 2 or 3 months or a month. And then they just get back in. They have their training camps, and their training camps are happening in March.
So what about these two, though? Yeah. I mean, did they, Wout and van der Poel, I haven't really, because they come right into the season.
Yeah, they would have had to take some time off, but very clearly they had it managed. I mean, they had a plan, because you don't show up like this if you don't have a plan.
Right, and van der Poel is not doing Roubaix. I don't know. His team wasn't in there at least, so maybe next year. Okay, let's finish off Flanders. Really, the action starts, like you said, what,
85K out.
There's a break there. And then right around the... Well, so we have in the break, we have Asgreen. Do you know much about him, Dakota Quickstep guy?
I don't know a ton about him, other than he just rode the race of his life.
Right. Van Barl of... Right, he did. Yeah. Sky. And then you have... was it Langeveld or... No, it was...
No.
It was... Let's try to look here through the... Yeah. It was the EF Education first rider, and it'll come to us. I don't have it in here.
Wow. No, I'm Nate. I know.
And he was in the final of Perry Roubaix. Anyway, we know who he is. He's a great rider. He ended up being a great teammate for Betty All, but the 18K, those guys, well, he gets dropped off, the EF Education first guy that we can't remember.
Yeah.
And then Betty All hits it on the Quarmont. And why don't you walk us through what happened from there? But first of all, your experience, how many times did you do Flanders?
Only once. I didn't finish because I had this horrific crash, which caused my back.
How far did you make it in the race?
It's hard to remember, but about 100K, give or take.
So, but you've reconned it, obviously. Yeah. You've been there with
I've
the
had
teams.
The experience.
And so what is it with these last two climbs, and has the finish changed over the years?
Yeah, finish has changed. So the race for the most part has totally changed since I did it. They have this kind of like finish circuit that I think the race in some ways is a lot harder now. They have the Pattersburg, which they never had before. The race has changed. It's different now. The weather was good this year. But what you did see was, for me, like some of the absolute, not shocking, but surprising parts of the race was number one, movie star. Like back in my day, the Spanish guys, they would do like 100K and then stop. All of a sudden, you have three movie star guys in the front, which is crazy, which is like, I was like, man, these guys. And that isn't the first time. I mean, they have been riding like this. Clearly, for the last couple of, for this season for sure. So then that's kind of a weird dynamic because all of a sudden you got a bunch of movie star guys up there that you're not normally.
We used to have Juan Antonio Flecha that would participate.
Right.
He was in a Rabobank kit or something else and he was not.
But it wasn't like these normal Spanish teams. Yes. Like these teams never wanted to show to these races. They always asked to not go. And the World Tour just made them go. Yeah. Now you have movie stars showing up with their world champion with a support network. Like he very clearly has riders in there to help him or vice versa. And they're participating in the race. Like they're really on. So movie star was a big surprise, pleasant surprise, racing hard. Outside of those guys, you had EF Education with three guys up
Sepp
there.
Sepp
Van Mark, perfect. And he was the next coming a couple years ago.
Right.
So you have EF Education with three guys up there, and then everybody else is kind of by themselves. So I'm not saying Betty All won because he had teammates there, but he was clearly had a good buildup. He very clearly was on good form. But, I mean, Betty All capitalized on the fact that once he got away and got that gap established, there was no one left to chase.
Well, look, actually, there was three Quickstep riders. So let's talk about that, because my thinking at the time is I'm not a big fan of their team for some. I don't know why. I'm just not a big fan of their team. So I'm looking for them to lose, and they're not pulling the guys back. But I can see one reason why would be you've got Christoph, you've got some of these other people that are going to beat you in the sprint for who you have, because they have Jungles. Asgreen, and was it Joubert? Maybe
no. It was the Belgian champ. Belgian champ.
Who's that?
Man, I need my computer. We're missing out on the names.
Either way, they're not going to compete with Christoph as an example for the sprint. So maybe you don't. But with 18K, maybe you do bring it back, because then you're going to be able to relaunch your guys. So what do you think about their move of not doing anything?
Well, the thing was, I think this goes back to my original statement that I think some of the guys that raced on the Wednesday were not great.
Okay.
And so that would have been Jungles and the Belgian champ, who had won Tours the year before. So you have Quickstep, which has this young guy that's in the break, and he comes back from the break, and all of a sudden...
Is it Lampert? Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
But all of a sudden, he comes back from the break, and you're thinking, okay, well, he's been in the break for whatever, 20 Kay, he's going to be done, but he's their strongest guy. Right. And he's the only one that was really chasing, because you could see Jungles was not great and the Buzz and Champ is not great. So all of a sudden they can't bring it back. And for sure, well, I don't know for sure, but in my estimation, everybody in the break is looking at the three Quickstep guys going, you guys have won everything. You have to bring this back. And they couldn't do it. And so by the time I think everybody realized that they couldn't do it, there's a bunch of ones, Kristoff, Peter,
Van Avermaet.
And you know, I make no bones about it. Van Avermaet from top to bottom is my favorite rider. But, you know, Greg had been lighting it up for at least 30K before that. At some point, he's going to be like, listen, okay, there's three Quickstep guys. Come on, guys, guys have to bring this back. And they couldn't do it. And he probably burned a few too many matches, exposed himself a few too many times. At that point, I think the movie star guys, it was just down to Valverde. I mean, he's the world champ. He can do what he can do, but he's probably not going to bring that back. So then you have all these ones that are in there and then three Quickstep guys that can't do it. At the very end, their young guy goes away, ends up getting second after being in the break all day, which tells you all you need to know. The Jungles was not on a good day,
right?
Which goes back to my original statement. I think the guys that race on the Wednesday, they spent too many matches.
So it seems like this didn't Terpstra win this last year?
Yes.
And kind of in that same mode where he's off and then people, the chase just really isn't materializing around him or behind him. Jungles at Liège maybe was the same type of idea. I'm just trying to remember these. But I saw it quite a bit last year when Quickstep was the team up there, and then you get, you know, you have eight guys behind and they're going to want someone else to do all the work for them. And it's these superstars. So it was really interesting.
But they really started racing from 30K out from 30K farther than they would normally start racing full gas. Normally like 50K. Okay. Time to go. People say it all the time. They would exit the long cobble section with the small cobble descent that goes the right, the left across the railroad tracks, off of the cobbles, right onto the smooth road. You go about 3-4K, you make the left onto the Tynenberg. Okay, it used to be you get to the Tynenberg, time to go. But this year, those guys are racing from far, far, far. First time they go out the Quaremont, that's where it started. The first time, that's 80-plus K to go. That doesn't normally happen.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the style of racing. I think maybe we talked about this last time I was here. You see this younger generation coming. The younger under 23 generation is used to racing from the drop of the flag. Drop of the flag, we're racing full gas. The older generation is moving into retirement, or they're not leaders anymore. And now there's so many superstars that these guys have to take it from farther and farther out if they want something to happen, trying to isolate riders and teams. And I will say, for good or for bad, whatever is going on, I mean, Peter is not, he's not as good as he has been in the past.
No.
Whether the past 3 or 4 years is catching up with him, which is justifiable totally, or whether he's been unhealthy and nobody knows, he's got a small injury, nobody knows, whatever it is, he is not what he was the last couple of years.
And I wouldn't take anything away from, look, he just went the marriage and then divorce.
No.
I mean, that could wreck you. And
of course.
I mean, that's what I do. A family law attorney, I see wrecked people all the time, but it could really set you back. I don't know if that's an issue, but you're right.
He's not what he was.
He's not on, and you can see that in the climb. You know, there was, 25 or so in that group when they were kind of shredding it out, and he was just lagging behind, and you don't expect, I saw Kristoff was kind of with him, but Kristoff is a bigger guy, and you just know then he's powering across, and that's just not Sagan. So.
Right. And I do think if you look at how the run-in was right before Betty All went away, there was that section. It was like a false flat drag up this really big, you know, typical Belgian road, you know, trees on both sides, concrete bike path. And there was a little bit of a crosswind. And I mean, the field was in the front group of 25 guys was in like four groups.
Right.
And guys were just, when that happens, that's not tactics, man. Like guys are on the limit. They're literally on the limit. And I think guys were really on the limit from a very long way out. And when you're on the limit like that, a lot, it's a cascade effect. You're not intaking calories, you're not intaking hydration, and it just catches up with you. And the next thing you know, Betty All, who maybe was taking care of himself because he had Van Mark in the break, maybe he was doing the extra little things, all of a sudden he gets to the point where he can attack, and then he gets that point where everyone's hesitating, Quickstep can't bring it back, and he goes away, and it's game over, Red Rover, and he ends up winning. And I mean, listen, EF Education has been knocking on the door for the last couple of years. Everybody deserves their time in the sun. They got it. They won one of the biggest races of the year. They had the most guys in the front. Langeveld just hanging out there in the field, just keeping track of everybody, shutting it down, making sure that no one goes away. And Betty All caught lightning in a bottle, first pro win ever, but very clearly has a really good pedigree. He just, on that day, for whatever reason, be it nutrition, the fact he got to sit in, or the fact that he just was the strongest guy, he rides away from the field, solos the last, whatever it was, 12 plus K, and wins. And good for him.
Right. So up the Coromant, he blew through the break and took it. That was his big gap. Very impressive there. Same on the last time up the Paterberg. And then it was just, as you said, taking into these guys that are not working behind and obviously doing what he has to do for the win. It was really good to see. You know, Sepp van Marck has been, not like you said, knocking at the door. And I keep seeing him. He gets in the break with the ultimate guys, Van Avermaet and these other ones. And you're like, you're going to lose in the sprint and you can't get away. So it was for EF and the Americans who support that team. It was good to see them take that win. Any other lasting memories from Flanders this year or even year old and past?
Well, this year, more than any year, I thought it was just a big heavyweight fight, and it was just like a free-for-all. And guys, and I
did
think
you enjoy it?
I did. I think it's, when racing is like that, I think it's awesome. I don't necessarily want to see four Quickstep guys in the front, like, riding everything back.
Right.
Like, I don't want to see that. What I want to see is what I saw on Sunday, which is you have a bunch of guys. I mean, the Vanderpool thing clearly changed the dynamic of the race, but even his story, which is going on behind the race, people are losing their minds because he's making his way back and you're like, oh wait, there's no way this guy's getting back. And then he's in the group and then he's attacking and then he's in the front. And then you're like, is this guy going to win? And it was like a legitimate question. And I think he does, in my mind, I think he does what Betty All did if he had not crashed.
I get it. Yeah, I think they're, and what, he still ends up fourth?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Which is amazing.
Right. So Skil de Pres happens today. It's the midweek, kind of like the Ghent, wait, the Dwarves in between.
Yeah.
So it was won again by Jakobsen, Fabio from, he won it last year, Dakota Quickstep. I don't know if you got to see that at all. I haven't seen it yet. All right, his final sprint. It's what it is. But does that play any part into Roubaix? Are riders skipping that? Are they doing it just to keep their engine hot?
Well, Skil de Pres is notorious for taking one hitter out because it's a totally flat race and it's always this huge bunch kick that it was just totally nuts. And I think a lot of riders are afraid of it. I think if you were a rider and you were sick or injured and making your way back slowly, Skil de Pres would be the way to go to just get that extra day of racing in. I don't think it's going to make any determination on what happens at Roubaix.
Okay. I didn't see any grand wrecks or anything today. No, I just perused it real quick. Yep. This is the one last year where they had the railroad crossing, and it took a bunch of the big riders out of that. So, okay. So let's get into that took out Taylor Finney, I mean, last year. Let's get into Paris-Roubaix. Let's start off with Taylor Finney. I just heard an interview with him this morning from Cycling Podcast. He has a whole new concept to his training. I don't know if you've heard this at all.
I haven't.
It's you should take a listen. He does. He's like, hey, you know, he's so nuanced now. That's the nicest way I can say it. What's your take on Finney? And is he going to be any force for Paris-Roubaix? Because it seems like that's when he kind of just shows up.
I would love to sit here and say I would love to pick him and say he is, because I'm a big fan of Taylor. I loved him. I worked with him at two Olympic Games and when we were at BMC together, and I love what he brings to the sport. I do. And I want him to win. I want him to win.
Right.
I just don't know. I legitimately don't know. He's got the skills. No question.
Right,
he's got
right.
the skill. And now maybe he has the team. So if the team comes in and the team is riding like they rode at Flanders, he could be the guy to win. The one thing about Roubaix is that, I mean, it's a special race, and it brings out special guys that do special things. It takes a special skill set, and Taylor has it. So can he make that happen? I want to sit here and say he can. I don't know. If he wins Roubaix, he's a legend. I mean, he's already a legend in some ways, but if he wins Roubaix, he's a legend.
Well, partly because he's done, I don't want to say nothing, but, you know, his season up to date and for the last several years, it's kind of been, you know, last year actually was a surprise. We talked about it, said, oh, I think, you know, he can, he's got, like you said, he's got the skills. So if things work out, no mechanicals, and his training is what we don't know, is okay, then he's definitely going to be in the running.
Right. The one thing I can one thing I can say about Taylor is when, and I haven't heard this podcast in his training, but just even you saying that and me knowing some things from the past, there's a chance. I will say this. There's if this guy like was that focused and that determined that he went on some kind of not random and not crazy, but he took a different approach, he thrives on that.
So I'll give you a little, and he said to the interviewer, thank you for asking me that question. I've wanted to talk about it, which was he's taking an artsy view to his training. In other words, instead of trying to hit, you know, 420 interval for so long, he's like, I try to think in my mind, I'm training for a specific event. So I'm going to be out there training to win Roubaix as an example. What am I going to do? Maybe I can't hit the hell. It really hurts. So I'm going to just take a breath and I'm going to breathe down and then I'm going to hit my, so I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, like I said, I don't put, this is one thing I've said from start to finish for the people who know me. I never bet against a Finney.
Gotcha.
Never.
That's probably a good thing. Okay. So Paris-Roubaix, did you do Paris-Roubaix?
I did not because of this injury that I had Flanders prevented me. I was on the roster, but I did not get to do it.
Sorry to hear that. And were you excited to do it? I mean,
no, I was scared. I was petrified.
But after the fact, you'd be like, oh, great. I have done that.
Oh, yeah. If it had happened, yeah, right. It would have been.
Now, have you done it as in the team car working at the race?
I've been in the team. Yeah, actually, I've been. I did. For those who don't know, right now, Pace Vasco is going on. So I used to work Pace Vasco. And the deal is, I can't say if they do this anymore, but in my day, it's for Roubaix, it's all hands on deck. You need every single staff member and their entire families to do the sections and do everything. So what I used to do is Pace Vasco ends on the Saturday. I would finish the race after it would usually end with a time trial. As soon as the last rider crossed the line, me and a soigneur would take everything off of the car, load our suitcases in and drive all night to get to the Valenciennes, where most of the teams would stay, and then I would do sections. So I spent 2 years where I did sections of Roubaix with a mechanic.
Okay, let's talk about that. So first of all, we're looking at, what do we have here? 200 and some kilometers of, and 29 pavé sections. So you're talking about these different sections. You would go out there probably with wheels and some food or whatever.
Yeah,
and bikes and everything. And just stand on the side of the road and hope that you didn't have to be used.
Yeah, so there's in most teams, there's actually one mechanic that his job for weeks on end was to plan the team Roubaix support network. So he would have maps. We would have groups. It's actually pretty funny at the same time. He would have maps, and you would have teams of two, like either two soigneurs, a soigneur mechanic and director, and director and soigneur. And basically, you would have your list of sections that you were doing. They would be all mapped out for you. So, like, you would show up at the hotel, and this particular mechanic would give you your wheels, your cooler, and your map. And the mechanic is directing with the map. This was a little bit before GPS was full gas, but directing with a map from the back seat. And I would have my sections that I would do. And after I did my last section, then I would go to the finish. And so it's a full-time, very stressful, full gas job.
Could you follow the race much doing that?
Yeah, you would have TV in the car.
But I mean the inner workings of the race.
Yeah, because you'd have race radio.
Okay.
So you have race radio going on and you could hear what was going on. Sometimes you'd be out of range, But for the most part, it's you're always going to a sector where they're going to. For the most part, you would have between your BlackBerry at the time, communication between the different moving entities. So whether it was the groups that were moving from section to section, or the directors in the car, or the, in our case, we would have Noel de Jonker at the service course. He would be texting us because he would be watching on TV. He would tell us what was going on, phone calls, the whole thing. I mean, it's like a race within a race. It's like a whole nother race going on within the race.
The logistics
part of it.
That's crazy. 256 is what we're looking at. So they don't start the pave sections until about 90 some K into this year. So what's that first section like, the first 90 kilometers, especially leading into that? You always hear about that when they're, you know, it's going to be, it's kind of like probably taking your climber into the start of the climb, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the first 100K is for a lot. For the break to go, that's the main thing. So for the breakaway to go, to get deep in, make sure everything's, you know, relatively working quickly. But the first cobble section is probably, a lot is going to happen. You have to have a lot of luck at Roubaix, clearly, between flats and mechanicals and not crashing or crashing or whatever. But at the end of the day, you hit that first cobble section, and if something is going to go wrong, it's probably going to go wrong there, bike, whatever. There's going to be, you know, I think the belief is if you have a mechanical or a crash or a flat, you want to have it early in the cobble sections because then you can recover. If you have it late in the cobble sections, there's a least likely chance that you can recover.
Is that because the guys are coming out and they're hitting full gas? And
well, you don't have your team cars there. Gotcha. So the first couple of sections, your team cars are still within range. You can't take bikes from the side of the road like you could in the older days. And when I say older, like 5 years ago. Okay. But you can't take... So and we could have bikes on the side of the road. You can't do that anymore. So it's like there's a lot of things that are going on. Again, if you can recover if something bad happens in the early part, you have teammates that are still there. You can still work your way back. The team car is relatively close. If you're in the breakaway, your team car is in between groups. That's always extremely helpful. I used to tell riders this all the time, like get in the breakaway so that the team car can be there, because the team car can work between sections, front and back. The team car, the number one car, is only behind the leaders. So if your car 10, as soon as they hit that first cobble section, game over, Red Rover. You're not going to see that guy for like an hour.
Right. So you talk about the early cobble. So there's 3 5-star sections. And, it's, you know, they have stars 1 through 5, and there's multiple 4s, 3s, 2s. But there's 3 of the 5-star this year. The Arenberg comes at, it's the big forest there. It's nasty. Comes at 162 kilometers in. Is that a decisive point for this race? It always seems like that's kind of a spot that, you know, you're either there or you're not. It doesn't mean that you're going to lose out, but you're going to win at that point, but you could definitely be losing for there.
Both. If you're going to be in the mix, it's going to be there. And then if you're going to lose out, it's going to be there. And so they have moved the barriers. I'm not sure what the rule is this year. They change it all the time. In the past, they had no barriers right up to the cobbles so guys could ride the grass. Then they, and the dirt. So then they moved the barriers right to the cobbles so you had to ride the cobbles. Right. That changed it. I don't know where they're at this point. I'm going to assume they have to ride the cobbles, which makes it a lot harder. The race to get onto that, because that's a 5-star section, that means the cobbles are some of the worst,
right,
or some of the best, depending on how you're looking at it. So if they get to that 5-star section, it's a full out race to get your leaders in the front. If you have a mechanical or a flat on that section, to get to a team car or to get to your helpers at the end, standing on the side of the road is going to be tough.
So in the forest, the Arenberg, I did read that, there was, due to the trees and everything there, there was a lot of grass and moss. So they were worried about rain, so they had to come up with an alternate thing. So what the people that helped restore this, they actually cleared out the grass, cleared out the moss. I think this is on the cobbles themselves, and then redid some of those early cobbles. So they're ready to go this year. Doesn't mean that they made them nice and smooth.
No, but they replaced some, and they've been doing that with a lot of sections. So there's a lot of sections that have these giant potholes, these, you know, grass, and they're not maintenance. Like, you know, for 11 months out of the year, they're not maintenance. And for years, they weren't maintenance. But now, over the last couple of years, the restoration has gone on to at least fill in the potholes and not have these giant, like, holes in the road. Or in the case of Ehrenberg, moss and grass. And it's already hard enough. You don't need it any more harder. And if you're not going to let them ride the dirt, then you got to do something.
Right. So there's two other five-star sections. There's Sector 11, we count down from 29. That comes at 212. That's the Mons en Pavel. You probably pronounce it. And then the Carrefour at Sector 4 at 242 coming in. Both of those.
Carrefour is always very selective.
Right.
And there's a lot. Like you see it now. A lot of times, it's not just the cobbles in themselves, but because they're searching for new cobble sections, sometimes you're getting these turns. And the turns are always like when you're transitioning from cobble to concrete or concrete to, you, especially if it's been raining, which I think this year has been relatively dry in the grand scheme of things. It's been relatively dry. It gets super slick, man. It's like you're transitioning. We've all done it.
Right.
You go from dirt to concrete or asphalt, and there's that little layer of dust, man. That stuff is, you hit that stuff full gas, even with a set of 28 tires on there, there's a good chance you're going to hit the deck.
So as far as the weather, I looked up, it's supposed to be mid-50s, cloudy, not really rain, chance of precipitation like 10%. So from now, it's like zero up until Friday or Saturday. I mean, things can obviously change, but it's not looking to be one of those epic.
Right, but overall, if it looks like it's been relatively dry this year,
right,
and so it's going to be dusty. In the lead up, it's going to be dusty and slick.
So what is your take on what teams are you looking for here? I mean, let's call some riders. The one we always have to add in, Sagan, we talked about, but we don't know where he's at.
Yeah.
Who knows what can be in that case? Then you have Degenkolb. Never know about Christoph, Nason, Oliver Nason.
So Nason's been riding well. Christoph, I think, is definitely a factor. Right now, Quickstep, if they do what they've always historically done, which I'm not sure it's going to happen anymore, but you go back to the days when they would have, you know, three guys in George.
Right.
Right. I don't know if it's going to happen anymore like that. They clearly have a team for that.
Right.
If that happens and they have four or five guys in the front, I think it's going to be the truth is Service Kanavan was an incredible professional, but I mean, he won Roubaix. A lot of that had to do with, he had a lot of teammates there. He probably would have won or could have won on his own, but it helped when he had like three other teammates there. So you could see that happen. But right now, EF Education has a great chance because their team is riding well. I mean, come on. They've got to be so confident right now and so dialed that does have a lot to do with it. Nason, you know, he's got AG2R is building a team. Like, they're building a team around the Classic. Right. So we could definitely see them have a play in this. They could definitely have a play. And he's riding pretty well. So I think, you know, I don't think you're going to have anybody come out of the woodwork that we haven't been talking about previously. Like, someone's not going to just show up. I will tell you, we haven't talked about this. Up to this point in 2019, my team of the year was actually Astana.
Well, yeah.
And then they have struggled. So normally I would have said that you got to look for Astana, but they did nothing at Flanders, and I don't see their guys just all of a sudden rocking up.
Who would they have for the Classics? They did have someone at Flanders that was up there.
Yeah, so they have some of the Norwegian guys that have gone there. And then
Magnus Cort Nilsen, I think, was one that was.
He was their main guy. Right. So normally we would be talking about him. And they had the Astana champ that was up there that had been riding well, but they haven't been riding as well. So I'm going to take them out of it because they just haven't been showing up. And they just haven't been riding as well as they were a few weeks, even just a few weeks earlier. So, okay. So if they're out of it and they had the Italian guy, his dad was, the big Italian, professional, starts with a B, damn it. He's first year in Astana. Anyway, I think we're going to take them out of it. So then, we come back to some of these other teams. I'm not really sure what's going to happen with UAE if, you know, I think Kristoff needs a little bit of help. He needs to have somebody else in there to help him. And we also haven't heard anything from Middleton Scott. And they have some riders in there, but they didn't ride overly impressive. I mean, it seems to me they're starting to focus on more of these one-week stage races in kind of the Spanish region, Italian region. So I don't know how strong their team is going to be going in. They have some guys on paper that are like lower first tier, like high second tier, but they didn't really do anything at Flanders. So I don't know if you can pick any of their guys.
Since Mateo Trentin, I guess, I don't know if he would be.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of their main guys.
Right. And since they've moved, since Heyman's win in 2016, yeah, they've kind of had that slow move. We saw with Caleb Ewing not being able to go to the tour, you know, yeah, all GC. So who is your pick? For let's give some tops here and then maybe let's start with that. I don't know if you have any.
Well, Vanderpool's not in, so he would have been my pick. I'm just telling you right now, he would have been my pick. Van Aert, I think Lotto, Visma.
Yeah.
Not Lotto Soudal.
Right.
I think both Lottos were big losers at Flanders. I think Lotto Visma was a huge loser. I think they did not have the race they wanted. They have great directors. So does Lotto Soudal. I think a lot of Visma's directors are a little more dynamic. I think that they're going to come out firing. I think they're probably really disappointed with how Flanders is, and they're going to come out guns flying. So look for them. I think Lotto Soudal, they didn't have a great Flanders. I think they need to do something. I think they're a little weak on the right now. They need to do something. They have a new upper management there. My old boss, John Lalonde, is their GM now. He's a French-Belgian. Like, this is his thing, like the tour and then these races. I think he's going to require them to do something. So I could see them being really aggressive. I guess in a general sense, it's hard for me to pick. I'm going to pick Van Aert. But what I'm going to say is I'm going to say that a lot of teams that didn't necessarily have a good Flanders are going to try to make up for it. If Peter is not as good as he has been in the past, I think it's going to be more difficult for Bora to make up for that because they're kind of built around him, Daniel Oss and those guys. Right, and if he's not great, you know, I don't know what happens. So my pick is going to be Lotto Visma. I think you're going to see some of the teams that did not have a great Flanders try to make up for it. Quick Step, it just depends on how many guys they have in the front.
Well, I think that's almost an intangible, right? Of like how many guys can they have? And is there any infighting of who's going to be that person?
Gilbert was sick at Flanders. Right. I don't think that was highly publicized, but you could see he was not great. If he recovers a little bit and he does it, I'm not sure if he's on the roster. Normally he doesn't, but every so often he gets on there. He could have something to say. Again, I'm not going to say that Roubaix is going to be a makeup for some guys, but I think some teams are going to put some serious pressure on their guys to do something that didn't do something at Flanders.
Well, if Lotto Soudal is one of those, then I'm looking for Tiche Benoot. I think he can pull something out.
I do too.
Okay. So any weird mechanical or massive failure predictions you want to, you know, the old Hincapie snapping a steer tube or even last year, Sagan's up there and, you know, he's messing around with his head tube. And then he's like, there's rumors about him hitting his front wheel on the guy's back wheel, trying to straighten it out. I don't know. But
he and Vanderpool are going to have some serious, like, crazy riding contests. I don't believe anybody's going one by. If it's anybody, it's going to be Trek. And I think maybe they learned their lesson at Milan-San Remo. Right. So maybe they don't take the risk. I personally would not take it. This is not a race you take a risk.
So weird because, that was Degenkolb, right?
Yeah.
Drops his front chain ring.
Yeah.
That's not the whole point.
I don't know.
Some irony there, of course.
Yes.
So I think he's a guy that's probably super motivated after his win from the tour last year of this race. So.
And he'll have support. He'll have good support. And he definitely could be up there. I just don't know where. He didn't look great at Flanders. But again, that may have been ramifications of the Wednesday before. So it's really going to be interesting to see how every, I mean, Flanders to me as an armchair quarterback on the sideline looked really hard, really hard. Yeah. And if guys are not recovering in time, it's going to be interesting.
Well, so as a someone that just watches the race, what I've always thought was interesting about, you talk about fatigue, about Paris-Roubaix is people get dropped on a flat road like they do on a climb. The cobbles are, to me, are like climbs.
They are like climbs.
And you come through this and guys just start popping it off and it's fantastic. Okay, let's pick some. We do a winners and losers thing. Okay. Any winners and losers? How about a winner from you for the cobbles, the classics up till now, and then pick a loser maybe? Unless you already picked a loser.
For me, the winner is Vanderpool. I mean, I know he's not doing Roubaix at this point. Yeah, his team's not doing Roubaix. They're not getting in at the last second. But yeah, I mean, he's the winner. I would say from a team aspect, the winner is Movistar. I got to give them credit for doing what they're doing. I mean, this is not in their wheelhouse, man. Right. It really isn't.
Right.
So they're doing a great job. I think the big losers, well, I think you have to go with these Belgian teams or teams that are built around living and operating out of Belgium. So Quick Step, they did not have a great Flanders. Yes, they got second. So they did get
like
a podium.
It's almost like an asterisk or an afterthought.
Right, but it wasn't their main guys. Right. So their main guys did not have great race. They still did get a result out of it. So that's legit. Any way you break it down. CCC, I'm just telling you right now, this is it, right? They are not built for any kind of grand tours.
No.
So if Greg doesn't have the support, and Greg needs support, not because he needs support to get it done. Trust me, this guy can do it himself, but that's the problem. This guy can do it himself. He needs somebody else to do it for him so that he, when he needs to do it himself, he can.
So let me read this real quick. You've got CCC, you have four Belgians on there, but you have Paul Bernas, Michael Schaar, Greg Van Avermaet, Gilles Van Hoyck, Nathan Van Hooijdonk, Guillaume Van Kiersbroeck, and Lucas Wisnowski. Who are those big? I mean, Schaar comes to mind. Van Hooijdonk's dad. I didn't know personally, but I mean, I remember. I don't know Van Kiersbroeck. Okay, I mean, who's their big?
Well, they need Mickey Schaar to make it as deep into Roubaix as possible with Greg.
Okay,
they literally need him to be as deep because those two guys have been together for many, many years now.
So he's hoping that he's got Schaar with him up until the end.
Yeah, he's got to have at least Schaar, if not two of those guys.
Great. Okay, so my winners, I'm going to pick EF Education first and Betty All, because that's just, they needed that, and they deserved it. And the way they rode, especially with the three teammates up there at the front, causing disruption, doing everything, it was great to see the interaction afterwards and his reaction. So as far as the losers, I don't know. We'll go with, you brought to mind Astana. I don't know that I expected much out of them for the classics, Flanders necessarily, but when they've been winning everything the way they have, you kind of have to call that. So, okay. Or actually, you know what? I'm changing that. We're going to Sagan. He's been the big loser for the.
But you got to, I mean, I will say, knowing, kind of watching a guy of his ilk with Cadel kind of go through what they go through, and especially a guy who's won. I mean, listen, man, that guy has, again, my experience with Peter as a fan or from the outside. He makes time for people. He signs autographs. Right. He does these events.
He's huge for cycling.
He's huge. He's huge. And if he's just having an off year, you know what? No problem, man. Because you know the guy will be back.
Right. At least he'll be putting out some exciting videos and some other things from home.
But I mean, maybe he's just having an off year. It happens.
I enjoy watching. And last year's actually race was fun to watch, where he gets up in the break with two lesser knowns. Well, I guess Terpstra was up there. So it was fantastic to watch and to see him do his thing.
And you know what? At the end of the day, even on his worst day, the dude's still in the front group.
So. I know. We're saying these things, and then there you go. All right. Any last one prediction or things to look for Paris-Roubaix before we sign off?
Well, all hell broke loose at Flanders. So I'm just going to say that these guys have been racing like this all year from the very beginning. I don't think they're running this conservative. And the reason I don't think they're running it conservative is because, it goes back to my statement, the teams that did not ride well at Flanders, they cannot have this happen 2 weeks in a row. So they are going to have to do something. So whether they put it, it depends on what the weather's going to be exactly, but whether they try to put it on in the early part of the race, whether they put pressure on directly from the first cobble section, whatever it is, I think those teams that did not have a good Flanders, their team managers are making it crystal clear that is not going to happen again. And so the guys that did ride well at Flanders, they did their thing there. Now these guys that didn't ride well are going to try to have a mulligan and make up. And so they're going to do that. And I think the race is going to be full gas from very far out.
All right. So if you like sports and you want to watch something, a whole day Sunday, it could start with Paris-Roubaix. It could end with the Masters later on in the afternoon. So fun day, a little bit different aspect, a different type of racing, and a little different money.
Right. And people are picking the cat to win the Masters this year. Well, there you go. I don't know. But
who knows?
I'm not the biggest fan of his, but no. What if he won, man?
That'd be crazy.
Comeback.
Right. Yes, it would. Okay. Anything else you want to add before we head out?
Thanks for having me, man. This is so much fun for me. Good. I really enjoy it. You know, I'm a NorCal homie. Right. I've missed everybody the last couple of weeks because I haven't been able to race. But at the end of the day, it's probably going to be a few more weeks before I even think about getting out there. But miss doing the group rides, miss being with everybody. Everybody's had a great spring. It's been a little weird spring here because a lot of rain.
Right.
But I just want to tell everybody that, you know, appreciate everybody's out there doing it, whatever it is, you know, gravel, road, mountain, whatever. So hopefully I'll get to do a little bit this summer. And as always, I appreciate being here.
Yeah, no problem. So we did miss you at Chico. So just so you know, I personally missed your team out there railing it for us. So welcome back, hopefully in a few weeks, and we'll see you out on the road.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Between Two Wheels podcast, check us out on our YouTube channel. You get to see Mike and I sitting on the couch together anywhere else this podcast is found. And thanks again.